We're going to go on into Ezekiel tonight. It is always essential to handle these Old Testament books in context. I've said that before, but I want to reiterate it. But the tendency of the ignorance is to pick text out of any part of the Bible and assume that they are for everybody. You know, and so you grab a text out of the Old Testament and out of the for New Testament usage and so forth, and they become well, instead of proof texts, they become pretexts. It's confusing to Christians, and because you have certain religious groups like the Ambassador Group, the so-called Church of God, who grab texts out of any part of the Bible that suits their fancy, and they are often completely misapplied. But there are, on the other hand, a lot of texts that we can properly apply. Anyway, I'll pass that up and go on into the book of Ezekiel. There will be things in here that we'll find very fascinating, some of which can be applied presently, some which may be applied in the future, and some which may not be applied at all. One of the outstanding texts which cannot be applied to us, and yet is a very strong, commonly used and very strong condemnation, is the one in chapter 34 where Ezekiel, as God's prophet, is chastising the teachers of Israel because they have misled the people of God. And he said, I will require, and because they were, instead of warning the people of Israel against the coming doom, that was to be the Babylonian captivity, instead of warning them, they had failed to do so. And so he said, their blood will I require at your hand. When God has been very explicit through his prophets, through Isaiah and through Jeremiah and other prophecies, been very explicit about what is going to happen, and the false prophets deny that put the people off guard. It's quite a different thing than speculating today about the doom of America, for example, and giving people a false understanding about that. See, that's a different thing because there's nothing specific. Or if we had had biblical statements or something we could go on to say, absolutely, this is what God is saying, and everyone who knew the word knew it was what he was saying, and then we failed to tell the people about it, their blood might be required at our hands. But what the way most people use that passage in Ezekiel, this very book, is that if you don't go out and witness to your neighbor, their blood will be on your hands, say, for example. Now, that's a great misuse of the text. Now, Ezekiel was a prophet that was contemporary with Daniel and partly with Jeremiah. Remember, this whole discussion of the prophets, beginning with Isaiah, started around 750 B.C., and that is when Isaiah began warning the people of God, the Jewish people, about their apostasy, where they were actually going after idols. Isaiah's warnings fell on deaf ears, and then that was 250 years prior to the actual occurrence. All right, then came Jeremiah along at the time when the captivity was going to take place, when Israel was about to be taken captive, and they had not only been apostate, but also they had aggravated the king of Babylon, contrary to Jeremiah's prophecies. I won't go into that. But here were people that were directly rebellious of what they knew to be a prophet of God. Jeremiah, that is, I mean, the faithful knew this. The apostate may not have, but the faithful knew that this was a prophet of God, and yet they rebelled against him. Now, our problem today is there are many, many voices, but we really don't have any guarantee that these people are true prophets of God. In fact, there are many reasons to believe that they are not true prophets of God. That is, there are many mistakes that are made that show them to be careless as prophets of God. So Ezekiel now follows Jeremiah. Jeremiah had the same warning that Isaiah did, and in fact they came right into the captivity as Jeremiah is giving his prophecies during his span of life. All right, now comes Ezekiel, who is right at the captivity and actually goes into captivity with the people. So this is now about 580 B.C. that Ezekiel prophesied. So Jeremiah was around the same period of time, around 600, and Isaiah about 750. That gives you sort of a rundown of the things that are taking place. Now, as a parallel to set this historically, you can go back, you can compare it with Greece, for example. What was happening in Greece at this period of time? And that gives us a little clue to something of some pegs to tie this on and bring it down into an historical perspective. So, 500 BC is a watershed of Greek history. It was, in a broad sense, identified as the Golden Age of Greece. Technically, the Golden Age of Greece was the period of Pericles, who reigned primarily between 460 and 431. But from 500 BC down to 400 BC, usually that is the era that's called the Golden Age, and that's what where we get the prophecy. I mean, the philosophies of Plato and the great literary writers of the period known of that that period, the Aeschylus, the dramatist, for example, and Herodotus, different ones. It was that we had great sculptors that arose at that time. So it was called the Golden Age because it was an age of great literary and artistic development. But in addition to that, it was the evolving of the process of democracy. Pericles is actually the father of democracy, where you have a broad vote of the public. Solon, who came in 500 BC, sort of began the democratic process, but it was really only a vote among the very highly placed people. It was democratic in that it wasn't just a dictatorship, but they had their leadership and they had the Council of the 500, for example, at Solon's time, which is not a large number. 501, actually, because they had to have an uneven number. But those 501 were given the right to govern Greece, govern Athens, I should say. And so the name Solon is very important in Greek history, and he comes at the period 500 B.C. In fact, our present word Solon comes from that. Solon usually is a name applied or a descriptive word applied to governing officials, the Solons, senators and congressmen and so forth. The term Solon is applied to governing agents. But this gives you just a little feeling. Now, of course, at 587, we're just a little bit ahead of that. Then we're going to come down to the time of Darius the Mede and some others. And I'll talk to you a little bit about the history as we go through this book. But right, for the present, that's just sort of a general peg to hang things on. Now, Homer's Iliad was written around 1000 B.C., Homer is the one who gave us, or probably, I should say, a reasonably historical account. That is that it did happen, whether all the heroes were there or not, I don't know. But there was an attack by Greece upon Troy, and that was called by Homer Ilium. That's where the name Iliad comes from. The Iliad means concerning Ilium. And you may remember the general history here that as a result of the historical misadventure of Paris, who was the son of Priam, king of Troy. Incidentally, Troy is right up at the top of Asia Minor. It is in there near the Bosphorus or the Sea of Marmora, the Dardanelles, all of those are in that area, and that is the gateway to the Black Sea. Today, all of that region is Turkey. But the Greeks, under Agamemnon, attacked Troy, and there ensued this 10 years war. I guess you remember the old Trojan horse, perhaps, from history, where the Trojans, it's called a Trojan horse, although it was the Greeks that gave it to the Trojans. The Greeks indicated that they were leaving the area and leaving the battle, and upon leaving, left this great gift for the people of Troy as a sort of a consolation prize. But this great wooden horse that they were offering as a gift, and the unsuspecting Trojans allowed them to bring that, roll that horse into the courtyard of the palace. And so everyone thought the Greeks were going, and so they could at last have a good night of sleep. But while they were sleeping, the Trojan horse disgorged large numbers of Greek soldiers. They had used it to house these Greek soldiers and get them into the gate of the palace. And, of course, there was a great carnage there, and the Greeks won. That's why you have today an adage, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. And that's why, because that gift that they gave turned around and bit them. So anyway, that's the general story. Now, Homer wrote about that whole history of the Greek war between Greece and Troy, in his poem called The Iliad. You've heard of that. Some of you may have heard of the Odyssey also. Have you ever heard of the Odyssey? Iliad and the Odyssey. The Odyssey had to do with Ulysses, who returned from the Greek wars and went about throughout the islands on his way back to Ithaca, which was his town. Ulysses was one of the heroes of the war, and he made his trek back to Ithaca, and it's a long story that I won't even begin to go into, but the Odyssey means... the Odyssey is the Greek name. Ulysses is the Latin name. You don't always keep that straight. Odysseus was the Greek name, and he was the one about whom this is written. It's called, but he was called Ulysses by the Latins. So the Odyssey is the trek of Odysseus. Well, ever since then, our word Odyssey means a trek. All of this is taking place in this general time frame. Of course, when you get back that far, 500 years doesn't mean a whole lot. But between 1000 BC and 500 BC is the time frame we're looking at in a general way, from the prophets here in Isaiah down through Daniel. At 1000 BC, technically, however, was when David the king was on the throne. But that was sort of the beginning of the writing prophets, because that's when Samuel started, you see. Samuel was at the time of David, so that's 1000 B.C. So now you then come down through 750, which was Isaiah, and then down to this period of time, 580, which is when Ezekiel is writing, and the captivity finally ended in, about 100 B.C., give or take a few years, but that's when the captivity actually ended. That puts you in the time frame here. Ezekiel now is about to receive a great vision from God, which we're going to read about here. His name means God is my strength. You can probably take a concordance or something and look the name up in a regular concordance, and it'll give you God is strength. But it really is God is my strength, which is a little more personal. There's not a whole lot known about Ezekiel's life, but it's not all that essential. What is important, of course, is message. Now, what the book consists of is, in the first place, this great prophecy or vision of Christ, which we will look at. The first part goes again to the failures of Israel, and along with that, the promise of restoration intermixed with it. But then you have a whole section devoted to the judgments upon nations. And that runs up until about chapter 33. And then you begin again the prophecies regarding Israel's restoration. Included in that is an extensive section from chapter 44 to 48 that talks about what we commonly call a millennium. But we'll look into that. We'll dig into that section fairly deeply because I think it'll help to straighten things out for you. And it's a section that came to life for me over in Israel, over in Jerusalem, in fact, as I was sitting there observing the whole city of Jerusalem from my place in the Intercontinental Hotel, sitting in the lounge there and looking across the ravine. I studied that out, and this whole thing from the 44th chapter of Ezekiel to the 48th came into focus for me there. So we'll dig into that later. So that's, you know, generally the pattern of the book of Ezekiel. And I'm going to now look at, we'll begin to cover the vision of Christ. That is very outstanding. We have a remarkable statement about Jeremiah in chapter 1. Jeremiah's response to God's commission, or to God's request that he go and serve the people or give them the prophecies, was total self-denial. In other words, he said he just did not feel adequate to do this job. He says, I'm a child, and I can't do this job. And God said to him, say not, I am a child. And then he goes on to tell him that before he was formed in the womb, he had been called. That was a remarkable thing. That gave Jeremiah sort of an edge here, and it's really an important thing. I would say the more authentic, in general, the more authentic the call, the more humble it makes a person. I think when you hear people speaking brazenly and boldly about God's call to them, For example, people like Joseph Smith, who felt he was God's answer to the church of these days. And anybody who stands up and says, I am God's answer to the church today, forget it. They're not anything like that. It's obvious because of that kind of brazenness, because the call of God will be a very humbling thing and not something that gives greater bravado. And of course, Paul gives us the same kind of an example. And here now comes Ezekiel with a vision from Christ, from God, but it is a vision about Christ. Now, if you understand that, then you don't make a lot of silly statements about what it says. Now, the reason I say that is because there are very number of verses here that have to do with a thing called wheels. For example, I might read that. He sees these living creatures, but then he says in verse 15, now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the color of a beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was that, as it were, a wheel in the middle of the wheel. And then verse 18, as for their rings, they were so high, they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them four. Now, not uncommonly, quasi-prophets or pseudo-prophets will identify this with UFOs. That's very common. These wheels, these circles with eyes in them are UFOs. I will show you how absolutely idiotic it is, because this really is a vision of Christ, and I will prove that to you beyond any shadow of doubt, so that you will not leave here saying, well, maybe, you know, you will know for sure what I'm saying is according to the Word. But the first thing we have to understand is that this is a vision of Christ. And then we won't get into this kind of trouble. Let me read the verses here, a number of them, and then I'm going to give you some comparative scriptures which will help us to nail this down. Chapter 1, then, beginning with the first verse. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Kibar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. In the 5th day of the month, which was the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans, by the river Kibar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire unfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And they had bands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they four had their faces and their wings. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went, and they went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man and the face of a lion on the right side, and they four had the face of an ox on the left side, and they four also had the face of an eagle. And thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. And they went every one straight forward. Whither the Spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, and went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. And then, and now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with his four faces. All right, I'm going to stop there. Now that would be a very confusing passage of scripture if you didn't understand what was going on. But we can go, let us say, to Daniel 10. I want to get a sequence here, but let's look at Daniel 10. We're not going to get, even much into it, except just to kind of nail it down here for you. In the 3rd year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, but the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing and had understanding of the vision. In those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant bread, but neither came flesh nor wine in my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all till the 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. And in the 24th day of the 1st month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel, then I lifted up mine eyes, and behold, a certain man, clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with the fine gold of Ophaz. His body also was like the beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms with his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men that were with me saw not the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them. so that they fled to hide themselves. All right, so there is a hint to us of very, very similar images, imagery. There is more to that, which I'm going to show you later. Let's go now to Revelation chapter 1, verse 9. I, John, also am your brother and companion in tribulation and in the kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, who on the isle that is called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard behind a great voice as of a trumpet, saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, first and last, etc. And verse 10, and I turned to see the voice that spake with me, and being turned, I saw seven golden candlesticks, and in the midst of the seven candlesticks, one like to the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, so forth. So there's a very close picture of the same thing. Now, having done that, let's go back to Daniel 7. And somewhere around verse 9, I think. And I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. See, in Revelation it calls them feet. His feet were as fine brass burning in a furnace. Here are their wheels, and so you see the connection of the wheels to this vision of Christ. These, as we go proceed with it, you'll see that it's very precise and not even as general as it may seem to us now. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set and the books were opened. Incidentally, that is sort of a tie-in with the 144,000. I've given you the symbolism of 144,000 as the two groups of people gathered around the throne were the 12 apostles and the 12 tribes of Israel representing them, one representing Israel and the other representing the church. Now, both in the case of the 144,000 of Israel and in the case of the 144,000 of the church, you have multiples of 12. 12 apostles, 12 tribes of Israel. Why God actually really nailed that number down, I don't have any absolutes on it. But then he says 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. So without nailing it down, I'm saying that the multiples of 12, which come out into thousands, really is a sign of an infinite number. Even though it says 10,000 times 10,000, it's a Greek and Hebrew concept that meant limitless numbers. Thousands upon thousands might mean limitless numbers. So what is obvious here is we're dealing with the same figure. If you get that nailed down right away, then you can understand Ezekiel 1. Now we go back to Ezekiel 1. As we pick up various imageries here of Christ, you will see that it's all here. And in Isaiah's vision, you see, you have the cherubim with their wings, you see. With twain they covered their face, with twain they covered their feet, and with twain they did fly. Each one had six wings. And here too, Isaiah had a vision of Christ, which we can go into and show you that in all the symbolisms that are there, Christ was in view. And here with Ezekiel, Christ is in view. And Ezekiel is the book that really deals with the redemptive process, even at the end of the book where you have your final redemption, the final ingathering, at least at the level of the millennium. Now we go back, and in verse 4, I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great fire, a great cloud, and a fire unfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof as the color of amber, and out of the midst the fire. Now, I'm going to show you as we go along that the colors here that are identified are not exact. We'll show that from the Hebrew text. This one, this beryl, is sort of a color that is a combination of gold and silver, actually. We use the word beryl, which is an amber color, and then someone else says amber, but that's not exact. It is impossible to really exactly describe the color of precious stones, of emeralds or amethysts or anything else. You can try, but there's a kind of living quality to that color that's vastly different than the oils and various kinds of colors that we devise artificially. That's why these gemstones are always used. But what you are dealing with in all of these is the spectrum, the various colors in the spectrum. And what you are then dealing with is energy. And this whole discussion of Christ is only going to be vital to you as we see it as a delineation of Christ in the power of His glory and the energy with which He is going to accomplish all the things that He has promised to accomplish in the world, in the universe. The book of Ezekiel opens with this tremendous vision of Christ, which we will then go through and show you more or less point by point all the facets of this vision, and you will see them in other places in the Scripture, and notably Revelation and Daniel. Well, I think we'll stop.